So we shall read one verse from Bhagavad Gita as it is, chapter 7, Knowledge of the Absolute, text 16. Please repeat after me. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, chapter 7, Knowledge of the Absolute, text 16. Chatuvida.
Chatuvida.
Bhajante.
Bhajante.
Mam.
Mam.
Jana.
Jana.
Sukritina.
Sukritina.
Arjuna.
Arjuna.
Artha.
Artha.
Jigyashu.
Jigyashu.
Artharthi.
Artharthi.
Gyani.
Gyani.
Cha.
Cha.
Bharatarshava.
Bharatarshava.
Chaturvida bhajante maham.
Chaturvida bhajante maham.
Jana sukritinorjuna.
Jana sukritinorjuna.
Arto jigyasur artharthi.
Arto jigyasur artharthi.
Gyani cha bharatarshava.
Gyani cha bharatarshava.
Translation. O best among the Bharatas, four kinds of pious men begin to render devotional service unto me. The distressed, the desirer of wealth, the inquisitive, and he who is searching for knowledge of the Absolute. Please repeat. O best among the Bharatas,
O best among the Bharatas,
four kinds of pious men,
four kinds of pious men,
begin to render devotional service
unto me.
The distressed.
The distressed.
The desirer of wealth.
The desirer of wealth.
The inquisitive.
The inquisitive.
And he who is searching.
He who is searching.
For knowledge of the Absolute.
For knowledge of the Absolute.
Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Jai Srila Prabhupada. Unlike the miscreants, these are adherents of the regulative principles of the scriptures, and they are called Sukritina, or those who obey the rules and regulations of scriptures, the moral and social laws, and are more or less devoted to the Supreme Lord. Out of these, there are four classes of men. Those who are sometimes distressed, those who are in want of money, those who are sometimes inquisitive, and those who are sometimes searching after knowledge of the Absolute Truth. These persons come to the Supreme Lord for devotional service under different conditions. These are not pure devotees, because they have some aspiration to fulfill in exchange for devotional service. Pure devotional service is without aspiration and without desire for material profit. The Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu 1.1.11 defines pure devotion thus: Anya Bilashita Shunyam Jnana Karma Dhyanavritam Anukulyena Krishna Nushilanam Bhakti Uttama. One should render transcendental loving service to the Supreme Lord Krishna favorably and without desire for material profit or gain through fruitive activities or philosophical speculation. That is called pure devotional service. When these four kinds of persons come to the Supreme Lord for devotional service and are completely purified by the association of a pure devotee, they also become pure devotees. As far as the miscreants are concerned, for them devotional service is very difficult because their lives are selfish, irregular, and without spiritual goals. But even some of them, by chance, when they come in contact with a pure devotee, also become pure devotees. Those who are always busy with fruitive activities come to the Lord in material distress, and at that time associate with pure devotees and become, in their distress, devotees of the Lord. Those who are simply frustrated also come sometimes to associate with the pure devotees and become inquisitive to know about God. Similarly, when the dry philosophers are frustrated in every other field of knowledge, they sometimes want to learn of God, and they come to the Supreme Lord to render devotional service and thus transcend knowledge of the impersonal Brahman and the localized Paramatma and come to the personal conception of Godhead by the grace of the Supreme Lord or his pure devotee. On the whole, when the distressed, the inquisitive, the seekers of knowledge, and those who are in need of money are free from all material desires, and when they fully understand that material remuneration has nothing to do with spiritual improvement, they become pure devotees. As long as such a purified stage is not attained, devotees in transcendental service to the Lord are tainted with fruitive activities, the search for mundane knowledge, and so on. So one has to transcend all this before one can come to the stage of pure devotional service. Translation again. O best among the Bharatas, four kinds of pious men begin to render devotional service unto me: the distressed, the desirer of wealth, the inquisitive, and he who is searching for knowledge of the Absolute. So there is a saying, common saying, good is the enemy of best. Have you ever heard the saying? Good is the enemy of the best. In other words, we might be doing something good, but if we're attached to the good thing that we're doing and are not ready to move on to something better, the so-called good thing becomes the enemy of the better thing. So the verse here describes pious people who begin to render devotional service to Krishna with various motives. I can imagine someone sitting in the audience and hearing the first paragraph and feeling quite good about himself or herself. Oh, I'm pious. I'm pious. I follow the rules and regulations of the scriptures. I'm regulated in my habits of eating and drinking and work and recreation. And then when we read among the one of the categories among the pious people that they desire wealth, well, we could easily say, oh, that's me. I'm one of the pious people who desires wealth and feel very good about oneself. But then when we get to the second paragraph, where Srila Prabhupada explains that the goal is not to be a pious person and lead a rich life with, you know, pious activities in devotional service. The goal is actually to become free from all other motives and desire only to serve Krishna. One might think, oh, too bad. Too bad. That's not so easy. That's not so easy. Of course, we are not interested in artificially increasing or decreasing our standard of living. When we read that one should have no material motives, one should have no material desire, either to be relieved of distress or to gain wealth or to satisfy one's curiosity or even to have some knowledge of spirit and matter, it doesn't mean that we are renouncing these things. We are not trying to get them, and we're not in the mood to reject them. We're not interested. Our interest is in Krishna and Krishna consciousness, devotional service to Krishna. So, if you're afraid that the statement that one should transcend the desire for whatever, relief from distress or wealth, that it means that you're going to have to be full of distress or without wealth, and think, oh, well, maybe this isn't for me after all. That's really not what we're saying either. What we're saying is that, as Krishna says at the end of the Bhagavad Gita, sarvadharman prityajya mamekam sharanam vraja aham tvam sarvapapebhyo mokshayisyami masuchaha, that give up all varieties of religiousness and just surrender unto me. There are verses in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the first canto, spoken by Sri Narada Muni, and in the seventh canto, spoken by Sri Prahlad Maharaj, to the effect that whatever happiness and distress are due to us will come to us without us making any separate effort. If we ask anyone Do you want distress? The person will say no. Do you go to the temple to pray to God to give you distress? No. Nobody goes to pray for distress. But distress comes of its own accord. We don't make any effort, but it comes. So in the same way, Srimad Bhagavatam says, in the same way that distress comes of its own without us making any effort, similarly happiness will come of its own without us making any effort. Both will come according to our destiny. Both will come according to our past activities or karma. Now, does it mean that we should not make an effort to avoid oncoming traffic when we're crossing the street? Does it mean that we shouldn't make an effort to earn our livelihood because we will get whatever is destined to us? No. We take normal precautions to keep the body and soul together. That is not against pure devotional service. And we also make normal efforts according to our position in society, varnashram dharma. We also make efforts to maintain ourselves in a way appropriate to our position in society. We do that. But still, we cannot go beyond our destiny. We cannot get more happiness than is destined to us materially, and we will not get more distress than we're destined to suffer. They are already ordained. And the effort to go beyond our quota of happiness or distress will lead to nothing but frustration, because we cannot go beyond our allotted quota. Srila Prabhupada explained that in Indian languages, the word for forehead and the word for destiny are the same. And therefore, when people sort of lament their bad luck, they go like this. It's like it's the same as their forehead. You know this, Mataji? Everyone knows this. So there's a saying that because in the old days in India, Calcutta was the biggest city. Everyone wanted to go to Calcutta. They thought if they go to Calcutta, they'll make their fortune. It's like now people in India think, oh, if I go to America, I'll make my fortune. So then, they thought, if I go to Calcutta, I'll make my fortune. So there was a saying that even if you go to Calcutta, your destiny will go with you. In other words, you can't escape your destiny by fleeing to Calcutta. Your destiny will go, your forehead will go with you. That's the sort of play on words, that even if you go to Calcutta, your forehead will go with you, meaning your destiny. So it happens. There's a story in Persian literature. There's a similar story in the Puranas, quoted in the in one version of the Hitopadesha. But anyway, the one from Persian literature, it's the same point that a rich man sent his servant into the marketplace to buy some things in Baghdad. And there in the bazaar, the servant bumped into death personified. And he saw, like, you know, he felt like death personified had like jostled him and was looking at him in a menacing way. So he was terrified. So he ran back to his master. He told him what happened in the marketplace. And he discussed with the master. He decided he would flee to Samarra to escape death. So later, the master went to the bazaar to complete the work, and he also saw death personified there. And he said to death personified, "Why did you jostle my servant? You terrified him. You know, you looked at him in such a menacing way." And he said, "I didn't look at him in a menacing way. I was just surprised to see him in Baghdad, because I have an appointment with him this afternoon in Samarra." So we can't escape our destiny. So, given that our happiness and enjoyment are already ordained for us, why should we engage in extraordinary activities or inordinate efforts to avoid distress, to increase our wealth, or whatever? That's the idea. That what is destined to us will come anyway. So our valuable energy, human energy, which has more highly developed consciousness than the animals, you know, more highly developed intelligence that can understand spiritual matters, why should we engage that valuable energy and ability to increase our material happiness or decrease our material distress, which in effect is the same as what the animals do? Why should we do that? We're missing the point of human life. The point of human life is to engage in pure devotional service, because pure devotional service will actually carry us beyond the material world into the spiritual kingdom of God, where pure devotees serve Krishna in direct relationship. One incident comes to mind now. When I was in India, I served in India for many years. I was based there for almost 30 years. And so one year, we discussed, and so His Holiness Lokanath Swami and I decided to visit his village in Maharashtra, a very small village called Aravde, in Sangli district. And at the time, I don't know now, at the time, there was no electricity in the village. And most of the the villagers were farmers, and they basically grew what they needed to eat. And some of the ones who had more land sold crops to sell. And Lokanath Swami's family, I think, was quite well-to-do as far as the village goes. They grew grapes, sugar cane, I think. Began with sugar cane, and then grapes became more popular. So there was no electricity. There was no plumbing in the house. Now, I had heard when I first joined that Srila Prabhupada said that a civilization can be judged by how far the stool house is from the residence. You know, now we think we're advanced because we have it right next to the kitchen. That's like really advanced. But Srila Prabhupada said, you know, the farther it is, you know, the more advanced. So they didn't really have one. I think that was even another level. They would just go into the fields with a loto. And that was really quite pleasant. And then they would grow, you know, grains and vegetables, and whatever we ate was just grown by them, you know, grown on their own land. And it was like really tasty. Srila Prabhupada said that's the opulence of farm life, the good prasadam. And we went at a hot time of the year. It was very hot. There was no electricity, no fans. But they would, you know, they would fan themselves with something. And you can imagine no electricity, no radio, no television. In those days, people didn't have computers. So what did they do all day? Well, they spent time with other people. They got together and they talked. They had relationships. I remember how the relationships in Bombay, which was the most advanced city in India, how the relationships deteriorated when television came. It was amazing. We acquired, Srila Prabhupada acquired some property in Juhu, and just behind Juhu was a very sort of posh suburban development called the Juhu Scheme. And we would go door to door. We just had the land and a pandal and a few tents. We didn't have a proper temple yet. So we would go to the people. We would go door to door, and people would receive us so eagerly. They would invite us in, ask us to sit down, offer us something to drink. Fruit, sometimes savory, sweet, depending what they had. And we would talk about Bhagavad Gita and Krishna consciousness. Then, after some months, television arrived. But because they still had the culture, we would come, you know, whatever, knock on the door, ring the bell. They'd immediately turn off the television and receive us just the way they used to. But after maybe another 2 months, it was sort of like, you know, they thought a minute, you know. Should we invite them in? Or, you know, they'd invite us in. They'd still invite us in. And they would, like, turn down the television. And it wasn't too bad. Then maybe after another 2 months, because by then the children were addicted. You know, it was like, if they made a move to turn off the television or turn down the sound, the children would object. So then it was sort of like they'd take us into the back room somewhere, you know, where we wouldn't disturb the children. And then after another 6 months, it was Swamiji, now is not a good time. Can you call me at the office? It was like it was all gone. The whole culture was gone. And I don't think it's specifically because we were devotees. I think that the television became the center of their life. And so it was a great contrast when I went to Araude to see that the relationships between the people was the most important thing to them. They didn't have these other diversions. And there was no nightlife as such. The nightlife was that the village would gather in front of, well, when we came the first time, it was like so many people wanted to attend our program. We did it in sort of the village square, which is really just sort of a cleared area. You know, the houses were either like wood, very simple. But even other times when we went, not with a big group, I think it was just me and Lokanath Swami, maybe one or two others. It was the same idea. There was nothing else for people to do in the evening. So we would go to the temple, and, you know, there was like a steps, like a platform where it served as a stage as where we sat. And then in the open space, the villagers would sit. We'd have kirtan and discuss Bhagavad Gita. And Srila Prabhupada says that is what the life in India was like when he grew up. He mentions that he had an uncle that lived outside of Calcutta, and they would go to visit him in a tonga, a horse-drawn carriage, and every night there would be some discourse or performance of Ramayana, Mahabharata, and that would be in the people's minds. And he remembered he would get in the carriage with his parents. He was just a small child, and he'd fall asleep thinking of this drama he saw of Ram Lila or Krishna Lila, dream of Krishna. That was the culture. And people were happy. They didn't need all this economic development. But, as Srila Prabhupada often said, we're not trying to turn the clock back. Although, Krishna might turn the clock back with all the articles we read about the supply of oil running out or running low. It may be that cheap fossil fuel may not exist in, the estimates range, but 20 years, 40 years, 60 years may not exist. So then we will go back to a simpler life, which will probably be better for people. The values now are very artificial. The way of life is very artificial. And there are many other factors that could set us back, so to speak, which would actually help us to go forward. So, why be so absorbed with economic development, you know, getting a bigger house, a better car, impressing the neighbors or whatever it is. When just by the simple activities of Krishna consciousness, we can be happy, happier than through sense gratification or mental speculation. I was surprised, some of you might have heard this story in some form, but when I went to college in my senior year, it was in the Boston area, I met the devotees. I was a seeker, and met the devotees in Srila Prabhupada and decided this was what I was looking for. And I, in the first exchange with Srila Prabhupada, I understood that he was my guru, and I surrendered to him. So when my father found out what had happened, he basically offered me $1 million to leave Krishna consciousness and come home. And $1 million then, in 1969, was a lot. But I didn't think about it for a moment, because to me the difference was like day and night. I mean, there's no comparison. And he tried the same thing again a few years later when I was in India. It didn't really sway me at all. But later it became sort of something that people would talk about, like in India. And I was surprised, and then I realized they must not know what Krishna consciousness is. I mean, if they really had an experience of Krishna consciousness, they would know this. The money doesn't compare. So there really is no comparison. And the other thing, as we mentioned earlier, is that whatever we're enjoying now, which is destined to us, may not continue, even though we try to hold on to it. We just don't know. Or we may have it. There's another interesting anecdote. We eventually, in Boston, where I joined, we were negotiating to purchase a house that belonged to a wealthy man, a very wealthy man. And so when we went to his office to discuss the agreement, or maybe it was even to sign the final document, it was like 10 in the morning, or 9, it was early, anyway, between 8 and 10. He came in, very well dressed, nice suit, you know, jewels, and jewel ring, and it's like he looked like a wreck. Looked like a wreck. And it turns out he'd been up all night dealing with something. And he wanted to light himself a cigarette. And he was like looking in his pockets, his nice suit, looking in his pockets, no cigarettes. So he picked up a cigarette butt from his ashtray and lit it. Just like a bum on the street might do, pick up a cigarette butt. And I was there with Satsvarupa Maharaj, and afterwards he commented that, the purport where Srila Prabhupada says that they cannot enjoy their wealth, especially if they acquire wealth by illegal means, they cannot enjoy their wealth. So he had it. He couldn't enjoy it. He couldn't have a good night's sleep. He couldn't even have a fresh cigarette. So the laws of action and reaction, the laws of karma, are very subtle and intricate. And we're bound by them. We can't escape them. We might think that by our hard effort we're getting more than we would otherwise, but we're not really. We do have to put in our effort. It's not that we don't. But we put in a moderate effort that will allow us to have time and energy for Krishna consciousness. Because that will really, you know, take us out of this cycle of birth and death, this samsara. There are many important words in the verse quoted in the purport, Anyavilasita Shunyam. That verse is considered the Paribhasa Sutra of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. The Paribhasa Sutra means the one verse that sort of is the essence of the whole work, or sort of governs all the other verses in the entire work. And the whole Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is about pure devotional service. It's like volumes, you know, like chapters and chapters and chapters and chapters. It's all about pure devotional service. So, one of the words is anukul. Anukulyena Krishna anushilanam. Anukul means favorable. And this is a very important word. Favorable means that we cannot just offer Krishna whatever we want and expect him to accept it. We have to offer Krishna what he wants. Which means we have to know what Krishna wants. And we know what Krishna wants from sadhu, shastra, and guru. The general principles are in shastra, and the specific application we may have to hear from guru. For example, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, patram pushpam phalam toyam yome bhakta prayachati. That if you offer Krishna patram, a leaf, flower, fruit, or water, he, with love and devotion, he will accept it. He doesn't ask for any, like, meat, fish, eggs, or any such thing. So we offer Krishna what he wants from those categories. In other words, plant life. So one devotee asked Srila Prabhupada, well, where does it say that Krishna likes laddus? We always like to offer Krishna laddus. Where does it say that Krishna likes laddus? And Srila Prabhupada replied, for that you require spiritual master. There are details that you may not get from the books. I mean, if you go on reading and reading and reading, eventually you'll get more and more details. But just from Bhagavad Gita or even Srimad Bhagavatam, there are details that you require a spiritual master. So we have to know what Krishna wants. And the spiritual master is he's called the transparent via media to Krishna. In other words, we want to serve Krishna, but we're unable to serve Krishna directly, so we serve the spiritual master who serves his spiritual master, who serves his spiritual master, it goes all the way back to Krishna through parampara. Similarly, the knowledge, we want knowledge from Krishna, that also comes to us through parampara, through the spiritual master, or spiritual masters, plural, sadhus, sadhu, shastra, and guru. So we have to offer them what they want. We have to serve them as they want, not as we want. That's service in a way, but not really service. I'll give an exaggerated case. In India, you know the, probably you've heard of the Mafatlal family. At the time, they were number three in wealth in India after Birla and Tata. So there were three brothers. Aravind Mafatlal was the eldest. His son Krishna Chandra is a wonderful devotee in Bombay. And Aravind had a brother. And I went to see the brother in his office, downtown Bombay. And he was sort of a proud and boastful type. That happens quite frequently when people have money and power. They think they know more than they do. So he was trying to impress me with how pious he was or how religious he was. So he pulled out this, you know, beautiful silver little box filled with tulsi leaves. And he said, "I don't even take tea without tulsi." Like, wow, I'm impressed. You know, it's like, he doesn't have a clue. He doesn't have a clue. I mean, he got a bit, but he just doesn't get it, that you can't just, you know, have what you want and whimsically offer it to Krishna. You have to offer Krishna what he wants. It's true, Krishna appreciates offerings with tulsi leaves, but you can't offer him tea. You have to offer him what he wants. So that's more of a, you know, to us who have a little knowledge, it's more of a humorous example. But if we examine ourselves, we may find the same tendency. We know we should offer everything to Krishna, but we're attached to something. So in our minds, we try to adjust it as service to Krishna. But is it really favorable? That determines whether it's bhakti, uttama bhakti, or not. Is it favorable? There are many so-called bhaktas around. There's the one, I mean, not to mention names, but there's one that has a large campus near Austin. Claims to be a bhakta. Not just a bhakta, but Mahabhagavata. Not just a Mahabhagavata, an incarnation. Incarnation. But what they do there, is it according to Sadhu, Shastra, and Guru? That's the real test. Because he may say, oh, this is what Krishna wants. But is it what Krishna wants? Just because you say so? And therefore, Srila Prabhupada emphasized the central point, Sadhu, Shastra, and Guru, the central point is Shastra. We can see in the Shastra what does Krishna want. And if we're pure devotees, or even trying to become pure devotees, we will offer Krishna what he wants. So again, another exaggerated example to us, but we have to look in our own hearts. Are we really doing this because we think it's what Krishna wants, or are we doing it because we want it, but we want to be devotees, we want people to think we're devotees, we want to think of ourselves as devotees, so it's for Krishna. Now, it can be, like we were saying, good is the enemy of best. It can be that even within devotional service, there are things that would please Krishna more or less. And it doesn't mean that just because you're not doing what pleases Krishna the most, that it's not devotional service. But it's just not the service that pleases him the most. I had the experience. I had been in Bombay for several years, and we were embroiled in quite a legal and political battle to get the secure the Juhu land for the deities, Sri Sri Radharasa Bihari and Srila Prabhupada. But one of my older godbrothers, a very dynamic preacher, he had been in India, but when things sort of, you know, in the earlier days, but when things sort of got, when the emphasis shifted to these projects in Bombay, Vrindavan, and Mayapur, he was in the West. Anyway, he came through Bombay, and he was really quite a charismatic person, very intelligent, very dynamic. He said, "Giriraj, you're just wasting your time in India. You should come to the West." You know, and he was thinking, you should go to the universities. There are young people there. They'll really hear you. You're just wasting your time here. And in a way, what he said seemed reasonable. And he was an older devotee. But I didn't want to make my own decision. So I went to Srila Prabhupada and told him what the older devotee had said. And at the time, Srila Prabhupada was getting his massage. That was one time, at least the men who had that relationship with him could have some time with him and not disturb his translating or other work. So Srila Prabhupada replied that suppose you're massaging my left leg and you want to massage my right leg, but I want more massaging on my left leg. So if you massage my right leg, that is also service. But still, I prefer to have more massaging on my left leg. So that was his answer, and I immediately knew what he was saying. Even if, for the sake of argument, you consider India to be less important than America, like we would say the left is less important than the right. But still, at that particular time, Prabhupada wanted to put more effort into India. But he wasn't saying that you couldn't go to America. He wasn't saying it wouldn't be devotional service if you did. But he was just saying that he would prefer more, he would prefer for the masseur to concentrate on the left leg. So I got my answer, and so I stayed in India. So that's a little different than the difference between pious activities and devotional service. This is within devotional service, but some service may be more pleasing than other, but it's all service. And Prabhupada said the same thing about Goshti Anandi and Bhajan Anandi. Within devotional service, a Bhajan Anandi takes pleasure in his own performance of Krishna consciousness, of his own performance of bhajan. He may go when invited to speak, but his main interest is in his own bhajan. And Goshti Anandi, he does bhajan. You can't be a Goshti Anandi unless you do bhajan. And he relishes bhajan, but his main interest is to share what he has with others, to bring others to Krishna consciousness. And that is considered higher or more pleasing to Krishna. But Srila Prabhupada was very clear that both are pleasing to Krishna. It's not that one is and the other is not. Both are pleasing to Krishna, but bringing others to Krishna is more pleasing. And he said that some yogis like to eat sweet balls and some like to share them. But we should taste and distribute. If we don't have taste, then we ourselves will be shaky. And our effort to convince others will be somewhat weak. But if we're really tasting, then we can really recommend Krishna consciousness to others with conviction. But still, the process, I mean, everyone is tasting to some degree, otherwise we wouldn't be here. So we need to do both, and Srila Prabhupada emphasized that to have the potency to preach, you have to be pure. And to be pure, you have to chant 16 rounds and follow the four regulated principles as the basic foundation. And he felt that if someone had the foundation of the 16 rounds and the regulated principles, they would have sufficient strength and purity to preach and bring others. So it's not that difficult. It's actually not that difficult. But again, as Srila Prabhupada said, that the chanting is easy, but the determination to chant is not so easy. So what I just described, it's actually quite easy. It's not that difficult. But to have the determination to do it is not so easy, unless one is in the association of devotees. Then it's possible, and it gradually becomes easy, because the devotees will encourage you. That's why it's so important. I mean, like Prabhupada said, the first choice is, if you can, live in the temple. Second choice is to live near the temple and attend the temple programs. And third is to make your home into a temple. And they're all good. You know, they're all good. But it's just easier if you're in the temple or near the temple. But still, you can practice at home. But even then, you should regularly visit the temple. Regularly visit the temple. Get the inspiration to follow the temple programs at home. I know at Chaupati, where His Holiness Radhanath Swami is in charge of the project, they really emphasize to the congregation to come for Mangal Arati and stay through the whole morning program at least once a week, usually on Sunday. Because that will give you the taste. And then you'll think, okay, I'm going to do this at home. You can do it at home. It's not that hard. You just have to take rest early, get up early. The activities are not difficult. It's just that the determination. And that comes from the association. So that's why some even come the night before, Saturday night, when they're there for Mangal Arati, and they can stay through the whole day, through the Sunday afternoon program. But that experience, at least once a week, the full morning program, beginning from Mangal Arati, that gives impetus to the devotees at home to follow the same practices at home. So everything is part of the larger plan. We have to see, we should understand by hearing from sadhus, by reading in Shastra, to understand how the whole scheme works and where we fit in it so that we can progress, so that we don't stay at the same level Because if we do, we may not, you know, we may not have the same opportunity in the next life. I know, you know, we had many business friends in Bombay. They always used to say, you know, if your business isn't expanding, it's dwindling. You can't just maintain it. You have to keep expanding. And that's what they said. And I think it's like that with Krishna consciousness. You can't just sort of think you'll tread water and not go down. You have to be trying to make progress. You should actually be making progress. And that progress really is possible in the association of pure devotees. That's what Srila Prabhupada repeats again and again in the purport. Yes, you want to be free from distress. Yes, you want money. Yes, you want to satisfy your curiosity. Yes, you want knowledge. And even a duskritina, even someone who doesn't have that much piety, even he, if he associates with a pure devotee, can become a pure devotee. So anyone can become a pure devotee, but by the association of another pure devotee. And that's why its association is so important, even if we're pious. So that was basically what I wanted to say. Thank you for your patience. Do any of you have any questions or comments? Yes.
Maharaj, if all of our enjoyment and all of our distress are preordained, then that means that if a person brings distress to us, we have no reason to get angry at that person?
You are correct. But as with other points that we've discussed, there are subtleties. But in principle, I'll give an example that will show you how one's response could vary according to this situation. Srila Prabhupada was in New Delhi with some of the disciples during the war with Pakistan in 1971. And a newspaper reporter asked him, you know, he was trying to get Prabhupada to take a political stance, which Prabhupada wouldn't. And he said, well, what would happen if, I forget who the head of Pakistan was then, you know, what would happen if so-and-so came here and dropped a bomb on you? He said, I would think that Krishna wants, that Krishna is coming in the form of so-and-so, in the form of death. You would take it as Krishna. But another time, a reporter asked him, you know, what if some evil person came to attack you, would you defend yourself? And Prabhupada said, yes, why should I let some rascal harm Krishna's devotee? So, you know, it depends on the situation. And so we don't want, so like personally, we can take things as Krishna's mercy, or is due to us. But as devotees, we don't want Krishna's service to be hampered. Now, suppose someone insults me. Is that really going to hamper my service? No, it just might disturb my mind. It's not going to hamper my service. So if someone insults me, I could think, well, I probably deserve it. Probably deserve more. I think, what is Krishna trying to tell me through this person? What do I have to learn? But, you know, if you're trying to preach to people, and someone's going around the community saying, oh, that Rupa Nuga Prabhu, he is off the wall. He doesn't know what he's talking about at all, you know. Don't listen to him. And you're sincerely trying to repeat what you've learned from Srila Prabhupada in Krishna consciousness, then that's going to disturb your service or the effort to bring people to Krishna consciousness. So then we may have to, like, call the person in and say, you know, Prabhu, why are you saying these things? But even then, although we want to stop the disturbance to the service, even then we could still think, well, you know, maybe I need to improve somewhere, you know, maybe Krishna's trying to tell me something. And I know many, like, advanced book distributors would say that they would feel that the reaction they got from the people on the street was actually Krishna telling them something. Like, one told me that he would be distributing, you know, and say, someone would say, you know, all you people want is money. And hearing that, he thought, well, what is my motivation? You know, maybe I have become contaminated with a desire to collect money. Maybe giving the person transcendental knowledge so that he can advance in Krishna consciousness isn't at the forefront of my mind. And maybe that person picked up on it. So distributors who are in that mood, they often take the comments they get from the public as signs from Krishna that they have to really examine their own performance, their own consciousness, and improve. And sometimes a person is in a position of authority over another, and if he is, it may be his duty to correct the person. And not because he's upset and angry in a personal sense, but just because it's his duty. You know, like the father says, son, it hurts me more than it's going to hurt you. That he, even Prabhupada sometimes complained that he felt bad that all of his disciples were Vaishnavas, and he felt bad that he had to find fault with them. As a Vaishnava, we don't want to find fault with other Vaishnavas. But as a spiritual master, it was his duty to correct them and bring them to a higher standard. But even then, sort of regretted that he had to do it. He did it. It was his duty. He did it well. He sometimes expressed some remorse that he had to do that to devotees. And as far as demons, well, I think a lot has to do with your capacity. You know, if whoever that was, do you remember who was in charge of Pakistan during this?
I think it was Bhutto.
I thought so. What was it, Ali?
Zulfikar Ali Bhutto.
Yeah.
Zulfikar Ali Bhutto.
You know, like if Zulfikar Ali Bhutto comes in to your house with a bomb and he's going to drop it on your head, you could take it as Krishna. Now, if you're the one holding the bomb, you could take a different position. So sometimes the position we take is dictated by circumstances. It's like the famous prayer that, you know, God grant me the patience to tolerate what I can't change, grant me the courage to try to change what I can, and grant me the wisdom to be able to distinguish between the two. Yes.
Since most people come to devotional service with material motivations, what series of events or takes place that they end up giving those up and becoming more purified and less material motivated?
Well, he's asking, you know, people, pretty much everyone comes to devotional service with some material motivation. So what circumstances can lead to them giving them up? Well, the positive is to associate with pure devotees. Associate means to really seriously hear what they're saying and follow it. You know, it doesn't mean like externally, like Prabhupada would ride on the airplane. People were on the airplane with him, but they weren't associating with him in the sense we mean. Real association means to hear, to inquire, and to serve. Tad vidi panipatena pariprasena sevaya. That is how we associate with the pure devotee. So if we associate like that, that will work. Now if we don't sufficiently, Krishna may help by putting us in distress, by putting us in more distress, until we understand that we have to take shelter of his devotees. And there's the famous verse that Srila Prabhupada quoted in relation to his own life, where Krishna says, Yasyaham anugrinami harishyetadhanam shanai. That when I'm especially mercifully inclined to a devotee, the first installment of my special mercy is that I take everything away from him. And then when he's rejected by his family and relatives, then he will take shelter of my pure devotees. Sometimes it comes to that, and I've discussed with other senior preachers that sometimes someone knows the philosophy, they've heard it hundreds of times, they could even give a class, but they're not able to give up their attachments. And sometimes the only intervention that will help is some significant, whatever, illness or reversal in the material sense, and then the devotee will take shelter of Krishna. That's also Krishna's mercy. One man, actually his son, I have told this story once or twice before. His son was translating Prabhupada's books into Hindi in New Delhi. And the father came to meet him. He was sort of pious, but he had one problem, that he smoked cigarettes. I happened to be in the room, and after the first Delhi Pando, and the father came in, and you know, Srila Prabhupada asked whether he had been able to give up smoking. And the man said no. He said, you know, can't I get some special mercy to be able to give it up? Like he wanted like some magic, you know. Gone. And Prabhupada said, special mercy. Yes, there is special mercy. And then he quoted the verse, Yasyaham anugrinami, that the first installment of my special mercy is I take everything away from the devotee. Then Srila Prabhupada asked him, do you want special mercy? No, Prabhupada, no. I'll make my own efforts. So that's, you know, there are people who shy away from it. We had one preacher, he was with me once or twice here, Mahaprabhu Das from Bombay. He told me there were people who would not, he would just ask him to come to the temple. You know? That's all. Just come and see the deities. That's all. See the deities, eat and go vindas. You can go home. They wouldn't come. Because they knew, or they believed, that devotional service, Krishna consciousness, is a one-way street. Once you take the first step, you have to keep going. And then once you keep going, well, then Krishna takes everything away and you become a pure devotee. Well, we think that's great, some of us, but some people think, oh, well, maybe I'm not ready for that yet. You know, so maybe some other life. But again, Krishna's considerate. It's a matter of faith. Krishna's considerate, and he can give you more. There are many examples where Krishna gives you more. I've also given the example of Srinathji Das, who he and Mahaprabhu came about the same time. And Srinathji Das was considered a sort of simple person. I mean, he was very intelligent, but his father was a very shrewd businessman, Dharamsi Desai. He was a big industrialist, a member of parliament. And Dharamsi, Seth, passed away at a relatively young age, maybe 57, of a heart attack while he was in Malaysia or Singapore on business. So, you know, I would meet a lot of business people in the course of my preaching, and so the talk going around was that, you know, Dharamsi Seth had built up this economic empire, and now, you know, Srinathji Das, he wasn't initiated, Narendra. Now he's going to have, you know, he's the only son, he's going to take over the whole enterprise. And they were thinking, like, whether he'd be able to maintain it. And Narendra Bhai, like, he was, like, really a very sincere devotee, very serious devotee. And I visited him quite a bit at that time. And, you know, he's getting interested in Krishna consciousness. And people were giving him all sorts of free advice, like, you know, why are you doing all this chanting, you know? And then he was going to take initiation, and then you know, he's saying people he didn't even really know, he would just pass them on his morning walk, they'd come up to him and say, you know, you're going to take initiation from a foreigner? You know, like, give him all this free advice. But anyway, he didn't listen. You know, he remained very serious in his practices. And, you know, he would get up early, have Mangal Arati, chant his rounds, read, you know, he's very serious, and then go to the office. And his business multiplied, you know, it increased by leaps and bounds. And I could see he was so serious, he was getting insights into how to do his business from chanting. I don't think it was his motive that, oh, if I chant, I'll get it. But it was a byproduct. It was a byproduct. You know, Krishna wanted to make him an example. I think there were two things. Krishna wanted to make him an example that if you surrender to Krishna, you don't lose. You know, you're the gainer. And Krishna also knew that the wealth that he entrusted to Srinathji Das would be used in Krishna's service. So there are cases like that also. It's not, in other words, Krishna is very considerate. He'll do whatever is best for his devotee. And we have to have that faith. And if he thinks the devotee needs to have something taken away, he'll take it away. And if he thinks it'll be good to give the devotee more, he'll give the devotee more. So it's not necessarily like that. But if someone's materially attached, and his attachment is coming in the way of his progress in devotional service, Krishna might take it away temporarily. But then when he is rectified, Krishna can give him more than he took away. And Prabhupada said that you know, whenever Krishna takes something away from you, it's only to give you something better. So, that's also a false apprehension. But people could have it, but it's because they lack faith. So we have to remove their doubts. Give them confidence. All right, thank you very much.